And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Not only is it leap day, once every 4 years we get a 29th of February. Well, congratulations, here we are. But it's also one of those rare days where you can have a split screen of the President of the United States speaking at the border and the former President of the United States, he wants to be future President of the United States, speaking at the border. Who wins this debate on immigration policy at a time when most of the polling shows a 30-point advantage for Donald Trump on this particular issue? Somebody who's written about President Trump, who has written about this issue and the White House generally, is the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times covering President Biden and his administration. Peter Baker is also the author of the new book out on paperback, The Divider, Trump in the White House, 2017-2021. Peter, thanks for joining us on this historic day, I guess. But aren't you a little bit surprised that President Biden wants to take on the immigration issue, which seems to work against him, to take it on so directly today and in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think you're right to point that out. This has not been an issue President Biden has wanted to put front and center. He hasn't spent a lot of time visiting the border. He hasn't given a lot of speeches about the issue. He hasn't really devoted a lot of his presidency to highlighting the issue, because it is an issue that is damaging to him politically. We do have record numbers of people coming across the border on his watch, and that has inflamed, of course, former President Trump and his supporters. But I think he sees now an opportunity to push back, to go on offensive rather than defensive, because Trump sank that bipartisan deal negotiated by a conservative Republican senator, a Democratic senator, and a Democratic or an independent who caucuses with a Democratic senator. And because Trump said, when he told other Republicans to sink it, I don't want to give Joe Biden the win, it comes across as strictly politics. At least that's the argument you're going to hear from President Biden, that they don't want a solution. They just want a problem. I'm trying to solve the problem.
But President Biden is the guy in charge. If immigration is out of control, particularly unauthorized immigration, isn't President Biden inevitably deserving of some of the blame?
Well, of course, if you're president, everything on your watch is your fault, and almost nothing that good that happens is to your credit. It often seems like that. But you're right. He is the president, and he hasn't managed to figure out how to deal with this crisis up until now. He is now talking about some executive action that he would do that would kind of head north toward some of the Trump-era policies in terms of making it harder to claim asylum, getting people deported out of the country faster if they don't have a good claim to be here. And the fact that he's talking about doing that and the fact that he's going to the border suggests how much the politics of immigration really changed, right? There's no talk among the Democrats right now in that compromise that was reached and then sank by the House Republicans. There was no talk of the kinds of things Democrats usually argue for in any kind of immigration legislation, like a pathway to citizenship for those who are here in the country illegally, like something protecting what they call the dreamers, the younger people who were brought here as children illegally by their parents. None of those provisions that are usually the demands of the Democrats have even been on the table at all. The politics have shifted pretty significantly to the right.
And my question would be why, because I was wondering about that, because there used to be a bipartisan, overwhelming support for the Dreamers, for kids, yep, who were brought here, at age 4 or age 5, and speak perfect English. They've never lived any place that they can remember other than America. And yet that entire desire to give them a path to earn citizenship, not to just be handed it, but to earn it,
yep,
That isn't even talked about anymore. Where did the Dreamers go?
Not even talked about anymore. And you're right. And they're sitting in limbo as they have now for years, because they are still allowed to stay under the executive program that Obama first put in place when he was president. But it's been challenged in the courts and been challenged by Congress. And there's a, you know, there's no definitive, you know, guarantee that it's going to stay in place. So this is why a lot of people, certainly on the left and who are sympathetic to immigration, would like to find legislation to codify that principle, the idea that if you're brought here when you're too young, you didn't make the choice to come here, but you lived here your whole life, and you're usually a productive member of society contributing to America, that you shouldn't be sent away to a country you've never really experienced. And that principle, as you say, is a bipartisan principle, but it's just off the table because the numbers at the border, the pictures at the border are so stark that you even hear Democrats complaining about them in places like Chicago and New York and so forth, where the ripple effects of the immigration tide have been felt.
Okay, so right now it's very obvious that President Trump wants to emphasize the issue of immigration, and it's an issue that works for him. What does President Biden have on his side in terms of issues, aside from the question of all the various court cases against President Trump? What does President Biden offer that could actually work for him in persuading voters that they want more of that?
Yeah. Well, the argument is going to be, I think, really threefold. You're going to hear talk about the economy, that the economy is actually doing really well. A lot of people might not quite yet believe that or give him credit, but the unemployment rate's pretty close to a record low. Inflation's come back down. Stock market's at record high, you know, wages are going up. And there is a beginning of a sense that people are starting to feel consumer confidence has shot up significantly in the last few months. And so he's going to try to claim credit for that and get people to see that if he stays in office, they can continue to have a pretty good economy. He's also going to talk about democracy, obviously, and the threat that he sees in a return from President Trump to the Oval Office, a return of a President Trump, in his view, would, you know, raise questions about the future viability of the country. We have a candidate in President Trump, former President Trump, who talks about terminating the Constitution, who tried to overturn an election he lost, who clearly has a very different view than every other president has ever had about the institutions of American democracy. And I think the third thing you're going to hear him talk about, President Biden, generally this year, will be Dobbs and the abortion rights and the issue of freedoms writ large, not just the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but what that could mean for other issues like same-sex marriage and transgender rights, and now, of course, this IVF decision in Alabama, which plays into that argument.
And there should be some foreign policy issues, right? Especially the idea of the trend toward isolationism among some Republicans.
Yeah, we'll see if that's a campaign issue or not. Foreign policy often isn't very much of one unless American troops are on the line. But you did see, obviously, this week in Michigan, some backlash from voters on the left, Democrats, who are upset at President Biden for support of Israel. 100,000 people in Michigan voted for uncommitted in the Democratic primary as a way of protesting President Biden's approach toward the Gaza war. They don't think he has been nearly tough enough in trying to restrain the Israeli military, and they're concerned about the casualties in Gaza. So that's an issue for President Biden, particularly in Michigan, like a state with a heavy Arab American population, heavy college student population, and a very important swing state for him to win. But broadly speaking, I think the question you raise of isolationism, you know, Trump out there saying it would be okay for Russia to attack NATO allies if the allies don't spend enough on military hardware. That's something that, you know, often doesn't play much of a role in the political conversation, in a campaign conversation, but you would think it should because obviously it's a pretty important issue.
And then that brings us to the whole question of the Supreme Court and their decision, which is being understood as a pro-Trump decision. What happens with that? Do these basic attempts to prosecute President Trump continue to work for him? We'll be continuing that conversation with Peter Baker of the New York Times coming up on The Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved show, speaking with Peter Baker, who has been covering the White House for many years. He covered it throughout the Trump administration and wrote his book, The Divider, Trump in the White House 2017 to 2021. Now looking at the very real possibility of another term in the White House for Donald Trump, 77-year-old Donald Trump running against 81-year-old Joe Biden, something that none of us would have expected. If you were to look forward at some kind of surprise that could shake up this idea of the inevitability of a Trump-Biden repeat in the electoral duel. What, Peter Baker, would strike you as the most improbable but still possible development that could change this campaign?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people had wondered whether a conviction, if he had gone to trial, President Trump had gone to trial, former President Trump, would shake things up. Now that looks less likely to even be on the table because of the scheduling of the Supreme Court decision yesterday on this immunity case. I think we have to wonder about health issues. You know, either one of them, as you rightly point out, one of them is 77, the other is 81. If either one of them were to have some sort of a health issue between now and November, that obviously could shake things up. We've never had a race like this. I mean, we've never had a race between a septuagenarian and an octogenarian before, right? And so that's obviously, rife with possible surprise. Interesting, by the way, I read in the Wall Street Journal this morning, had a really interesting story. They point out that 8 of the 10 largest, most populous countries in the nation right now are led by people in their 70s and 80s. And the other 2 are about to have elections in which it seems like they're going to get septuagenarians as leaders. So there's something about this generation right now that's living large.
It's baby boomers don't want to let go.
I guess they're hanging on, and we haven't seen the next generation rise yet.
Yeah. Okay. If President Trump is eager to debate Joe Biden, he says he wants to debate now, even before either of them have officially won the nomination of their parties. Do you think that Biden is going to be willing to debate Trump and to debate him 3 times? Last time they only got in 2 debates, and they were uplifting and inspiring, right?
Yeah, uplifting and inspiring. Lincoln and Douglas were proud. It's interesting. I haven't actually heard them, the Biden people, say anything about this yet, but I guess I think I would be a little bit surprised if he debates. I wouldn't rule it out. I would be surprised. I think that from their point of view, it's not in their interest that the last time, as you point out, was not exactly an edifying event. And they can point to that and say, why would we want to go through that, X show again, that blank show again? What they won't say is, of course, that they worry that President Biden, would have a harder time keeping up. Obviously, he has had some memory lapses and some confusing moments on the public stage, and that wouldn't necessarily look good for him. But they can make the argument that why should he, the President of the United States, get on stage with a guy who's been charged with 91 felony counts and who doesn't believe in the Constitution or the legitimacy of elections. That's the argument I would imagine that they would make if they decide not to debate. And they could, by the way, point out that Trump himself is the guy who chose not to debate in the Republican primaries. If it's good enough for him, then why shouldn't Biden avail himself of the same choice?
And your best guess about President Trump and his selection for a running mate?
It's a great question. I think one thing we should all start with on these parlor games is the idea that we're all going to be wrong, because he is, in fact, known to surprise people and make decisions that wouldn't fit into the normal criteria that we would set for that. But I think he's going to look for somebody, first and foremost, who he thinks is 100%, maybe 150% loyal, right? Because even Mike Pence, who was really, really loyal to him for 365 days times 3.5 and times, almost up to the very, very end, right? There was never a moment when Mike Pence did anything to cause President Trump to worry about his loyalty until the very end. So he's going to be looking for somebody who is even more willing to go along with whatever it is that he wants to do all the way through 4 years, no matter how much it might push the envelope of constitutional law and so forth. And who is that? Who would that be? Well, you're seeing a lot of candidates out there right now, I think, playing to that that audience of one. You know, Tim Scott, Kristi Noem, Elise Stefanik, J.D. Vance. They seem to be competing for the title of most vigorously pro-Trump, candidate.
And what about the stolen election narrative? It does seem that President Trump isn't retreating an inch. He believes that he won the election of 2020, and he won it in a landslide, and he got more votes than anybody ever got, and yet he isn't president of the United States. Could that actually end up hurting him, given the fact that a majority of Americans do believe that President Biden is the properly and legally elected president of the United States?
Well, it's a good question about whether people who don't, who aren't energized about that right now become energized about it, right? Because obviously the people who are energized about that, who do find that troubling and worrisome, are already decided they're not going to vote for former President Trump again. The question of whether President Biden can put it on the table in a context that reminds those voters who are kind of unhappy with him right now, those independents and some Democrats who've kind of drifted away from him because of his age or because of inflation or because of, you know, Gaza or what have you, if he can make that issue more salient to them, that you're going to be voting for, or if you just simply don't vote, allowing in to office a guy who doesn't believe in elections, you know, then it can have some effect. But it's hard to see. I think people have kind of grown tired of that conversation to some extent. People have made up their minds about it one way or the other, and they're looking to talk about the future. And I don't know. We've never seen anything for us to judge how this might play out from history. You know, there's nothing to point back to say, well, like, it worked this way in 19 blah, 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 you know.
And what about Gaza, which you mentioned? President Trump made a very big point when he was president that he was the most pro-Israel president we've ever had. He did the Abraham Accords. He moved the embassy. Is he going to make a play for the anti-Israel, pro-Hamas segment of the population that showed up in Michigan?
No, but I think he's just going to keep quiet. Rather than remind people of the record you just talked about, he's just going to let those people be angry at President Biden and simply not vote. They're not going to turn around probably and vote for former President Trump for all the reasons you just said, and not to mention the Muslim ban. But he, you know, so President Trump has not been talking, former President Trump has not been talking about the Middle East much at all, hasn't been reminding people of that. I think he's more than happy to let Biden stew and the discontent on the left and see if that might help him without trying to make a play for those voters himself.
Peter Baker, always insightful and sharp and knowledgeable on the presidency of the United States and the presidential campaign. His most recent columns are linked at our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be coming up to dueling press conferences on the border, or will they answer questions? We will get to that and more coming up on this Leap Day on The Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there's all kinds of ramifications of the what has been described as defiant testimony yesterday by Hunter Biden. I do think that this is one of those issues that that probably is going to get shunted aside while people focus on the border, on the war in Gaza. Maybe, I hope, on Ukraine and the survival of Ukraine. But the issue of Hunter Biden and the attempt to defeat President Biden by impeachment proceedings, I don't think that's going to go very far. There was today a reporter who yelled a rather uncomfortable question at Hunter Biden while his lawyer was giving a press conference. This is yesterday, clip 10.
That there was any financial transactions that involved Hunter with his father, period. It seems to me that the Republican members wanted to spend more time talking about my client's addiction than they could ask any question that had anything to do with what they call their impeachment inquiry. So, as I said before, there is no evidence because there is no evidence, and today only confirm that. Thank you.
Will you come back for a public hearing?
Will you do a public hearing? Mr. Biden, was the cocaine at the White House yours?
Mr. Biden, was the cocaine at the White House yours? And the response from the attorney was, there is no evidence because there is no evidence, and today only confirms that. In terms of Mitch McConnell's announcement yesterday, which shook up the political world, I mean, he has been in the Senate and a leader of the Republican body in the Senate, either as majority leader or minority leader, 40 years. And Chuck Todd on MSNBC asked if McConnell's decision to end his majority leadership. He's not going anywhere. He has three more years to serve in the U.S. Senate. He was elected to that, and he's going to continue. But there's a belief, at least by Chuck Todd, that there might be some underlying message that people should pay attention to. This is clip four.
Well, I almost wonder if this is his way of endorsing Trump. I was sort of like, we've been hearing that the two camps have been talking, and it's like, what's the ultimate gift to Trump? You won't have to deal with me if you win the presidency. So maybe McConnell doesn't actually formally endorse. This is what he does in lieu of. Again, I'm being a little tongue in cheek there, but I think he did it early because the speculation's already out there. There already was a shadow campaign. There's already been this assumption that he probably isn't going to be leader after this calendar year. So rather than have this whisper campaign sort of be under, I think he decided to rip the Band-Aid off, and in some ways it takes him out of the crosshairs, because governing is done for the year. They kind of have a path, you know, to government funding here that isn't pretty, but it's, I think McConnell assumes that they know kind of what's going to happen here, whether there's a quick shutdown or not, continuing resolution, but this isn't going to be, there probably isn't going to be passing a lot of bills. I think they're just going to do whatever they can to keep the lights on. And I think he kind of knows it's done, so why not make that announcement now? It strikes me as a way to just sort of rip the Band-Aid off.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't want the indignity of being challenged by President Trump, who has said repeatedly and very forcefully he doesn't want Mitch McConnell to continue as majority leader. So that's one wish that has come true. Somebody else who is leaving the Senate, his term runs out by next January, is Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. And he spoke extremely passionately and effectively about the importance of sustaining and renewing the American aid that is so crucial to Ukraine in terms of its fight for survival. This is clip nine.
That we honor our commitments, and we stand with our friends, and we will help freedom fighters around the world who are our friends and allies. And that's a message which is important to the people in Taiwan, to the people in Japan, to the people in India, to the people in Europe. I mean, all these people are watching to see, can you count on America? Or is America so isolationist it doesn't care what happens to the rest of us? If that's the case, by the way, if we cede leadership, if we're no longer the leader of the free world, if we're no longer the arsenal of democracy, then the world is going to look for different leaders. And I know at least one player that's happy to step into that role, and that's China. And a world where Xi Jinping is the leader of the world is a very dangerous world, and not good for America, not good for our businesses, for our economy, but certainly not good for our freedom.
And then Caitlin Collins over at CNN had an uncomfortable question for Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney actually seemed surprisingly eager to answer the question. Listen, clip six.
Would you vote for Donald Trump over Joe Biden?
No, absolutely not. I mean, for me, there are two factors in deciding who I want to have as the leader of my country and the person who is the example of the president for my kids and my grandkids. One is their position and policies. And on foreign policy, I'm not aligned with Donald Trump, at least as I understand his policy. On domestic policy, yeah, I align with many of his domestic policies. But there's another dimension besides policy, and that's character. And I think what America is as a nation, what has allowed us to be the most powerful nation on earth and the leader of the earth, is the character of the people who have been our leaders, past presidents, but also mothers, fathers, church leaders, university presidents, and so forth. Having a president who is so defaulted of character would have an enormous impact on the character of America. And for me, that's the primary consideration.
does that sound like it could work, adapted as a Joe Biden ad? Conceivably. Meanwhile, Yulia Navalnaya, the widow of Alexei Navalny, spoke to the European Parliament, and Yulia Navalnaya said sanctions won't be enough to deter Vladimir Putin. Listen.
This is the answer to the question. If you really want to defeat Putin, you have to become an innovator. You have to stop being boring. You cannot hurt Putin with another resolution or another set of sanctions. That is no different from the previous ones. You cannot defeat him by thinking he is a man of principle who has morals and rules. He is not like that, and Alexei realized that a long time ago. You are not dealing with a politician, but with a bloody monster.
You're not dealing with a politician, but with a bloody monster. And this issue, again, particularly in the aftermath of Alexei Navalny's killing, and 47 years old, and with all of the disputes about allowing his funeral or allowing his internment in different places, this is profoundly disturbing and very important and relevant for helping to shape a more committed, more principled American policy toward Ukraine. Speaking of more committed and more conscientious, a new poll on the least religious city in the United States. Which town do you think won that dubious prize? We'll get to it coming up on The Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show. All across America. This is The Michael Medved Show. More Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, don't miss the opportunity right now to join us with everything Medhead, commercial-free, on-demand Michael Medved radio show podcast, In the Light of History podcast, commentaries, calls of the week, and the Medved History Store discounts. Plus, if you join us as a Medhead Plus member, you get to stream every single audio program that is available in the Michael Medved History Store, including a detailed and a two-part series on the whole history of the Middle Eastern conflict. Hundreds of hours, literally several hundred hours, of insightful history programming from the Revolutionary War, the first Thanksgiving, the first big British colony in the future United States that didn't work out. It actually disappeared. Where did the lost colony of Roanoke go? We have a whole history show on that. Ronald Reagan, JFK, and much, much more. Check it out. at michaelmedved.com. There is now a opinion polls on what I never really thought would be an issue, but then sometimes there are court decisions that can surprise you. And that was the case with the Alabama Supreme Court decision that showed that their interpretation of the law was that frozen embryos counted as children and deserved the same kind of legal protections as children received. This apparently has been an issue resonating with Democrats already charged up by election year messaging about abortion. This according to a new Axios Ipsos poll. The driving the news, 66% of the public at large opposes designating in vitro fertilization embryos as children and holding those who destroy them legally responsible. 31%, so half as many, actually support treating the embryos as children. The Republicans are divided on the question. 49 support treating embryos as children and 49% oppose. The majority of the country still isn't familiar with the ruling. That's 54%. But within a week of it, the decision, 65% of Democrats were aware, compared with 35% of Republicans. And Democrats are tuned in a big way, said Ipsos Vice President Mallory Newell. And while the Alabama ruling doesn't outlaw in vitro fertilization, its effects have left a significant portion of the population viewing it as a restriction that sets out of step with where the public is at. The one thing that when you ask people about whether they favor infertile couples who are having a very tough time conceiving a baby but want a baby, the idea that there's a big segment of the public who wants to stand in their way, that does not appear to be the case. Speaking of a big segment of the public, there's a headline that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Headline says, Berkeley lets loose an anti-Semitic mob. Anti-Semitism took a frightening turn Monday of this week at the University of California, Berkeley, where a pro-Palestinian mob surrounded a campus auditorium, broke a window, and harassed Jewish students trying to enter the building. Israeli lawyer Ron Bar Yoshafat was invited by a Jewish student group to address the subject of Israel and international law. This included discussing the rules of wartime conduct and how the IDF can better protect civilians. But the speech never happened, as besieged Jewish students gathered inside a nearly empty auditorium at Zellerbach Playhouse, while some 200 protesters chanted, "Intifada! Intifada!" and "Free Palestine," and banged on windows, surrounding and shouting at those trying to enter. Students and the speaker were evacuated for their personal safety. The idea that they were chanting Intifada, the Intifada was the so-called uprising. There were two of them. The most recent one was early in this century, in the years 2001 to 2005. That Intifada, the main weapon that was used was suicide bombing. Was people going onto buses or into restaurants or elsewhere and blowing themselves up, killing themselves, destroying themselves into little bloody chunks of flesh in order to murder Jewish people. And the group of students at Berkeley were captured on a video clip shouting, "Jew, Jew, Jew, Jew," in the face of various attendees at this conference, one of the participants got spat on into his face. Other students reported heckling and harassment as they tried to get past the mob. There is no way to know how many other students stayed away out of fear of the mob or social ostracism for merely showing up. The idea that there has been no discipline yet on the students who provoked this kind of violent response, that is appalling. And that kind of expulsion for interfering with allowing a speaker on campus who has been invited to campus to speak about the laws of war, that is appalling. I mentioned before there is a question about the least religious city in the country. And what's interesting about it is the article in the Seattle Times almost takes it as a point of pride. It turns out that of all the cities in the United States, Seattle is the least religious. And that is measured based on the attendance at church, synagogue, any kind of religious participation. They write that Americans have grown less religious over the past couple of decades, and attendance at religious services is down across the country. Of course, some parts of the country are a lot less religious than others. New survey data show that Seattle is one of those places. A clear majority of adults in the Seattle area, 64%, say they never attend church or religious services or go less than once a year. That pencils out to about 1.98 million people out of the total 3.1 million population aged 18 and older in our metro area. And the survey includes data from all 50 states plus the nation's 15 largest metro areas, including Seattle. And among those 15 largest metro areas, Seattle ranked as the least religious, edging out San Francisco, where 63% never attend religious services or go less than once a year. Boston was a distant third at 56%. That, of course, is ironic because Boston, as much as any place in the country, and this was also true of Philadelphia. Philadelphia was started as a Quaker refuge. It was started by and for a religious group. That was true very much for Boston, where it was people were legally obligated to attend and participate in religious activities. Boston was founded as a Puritan settlement, and now 63% never attend religious services. The southern parts of the U.S. tend to be more religious, so Seattle may be as far north as we are. So it's not surprising to see three Sunbelt cities with the lowest share of non-religious residents. Part of the reason why, I am quite sure, is that Seattle has a lot of newcomers. It is a place where a lot of people go right after graduating from college. And when people are new at a place, they often don't have the kinds of connections that make for religious participation in this greatest nation on God's green earth.